we're here with our interview. We've got Brad Friedman of thebradblog.com and Clint Curtis. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Julie, how are you?
Great. So I think we'll just start with you, Clint, because you've got kind of the background to the whole story here, a story I must say I'm very excited about. It's quite amazing. So why don't you just start telling us what happened to you in October of 2000?
Well, October of 2000, I was working for a company in Oviedo, Florida, down by Orlando. And we have all kinds of contracts with the state and NASA and all kinds of government installations, as well as some private ones. And during that time, there was a fellow on our payroll named Tom Feeney, who was our chief lobbyist, the head corporate attorney, and also just happened to be the incoming Speaker of the House for the Florida legislature. Really convenient to have that sort of thing, you know?
Mm.
And his job was to feed us contracts and ask us if we could do certain things that would, you know, would allow us to get contracts, and then either we could do them or we couldn't. And I was the technology advisor. So this was like the first couple of meetings that I met him, and, you know, I didn't know that he was completely crooked at this point, but he came in. Well, there are other ways to say it, but I think that sums it up the best.
Right.
So he came in, and he asked if we could build a prototype for a voting program that can actually flip the vote and still be undetectable.
To rig the election, to rig an election.
Rig an election. And he basically wanted three things. He wanted it to be touchscreen capable, which means, you know, you could touch the screen, and that's the way it works. He wanted it to be able to operate without any additional equipment. You didn't have to bring in a keyboard. You didn't have to have some high-tech device. Just stamp the screen, hit some button somewhere, and make things happen.
Was this for the 2000 election?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm a programmer. I just sit in the back and answer questions.
Right.
I don't code. I don't know anything, right?
And what was his reason for wanting you to design this program, like, allegedly? I mean, I'm sure he didn't say, we want to rig the vote, or did he?
No. Well, actually, that came later.
Okay.
But what I thought he wanted, because, you know, I don't ask questions, I just write code. So I assumed, because I was a Republican, he was a Republican, you know, the head of the company that was there also was a Republican, and basically, I just assumed that he thought the Democrats had some sort of program that would do this, and he wanted to know how to block it.
Mm.
That was just my guess, because what else could there be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a Republican. He wouldn't do anything bad. What's the matter with you?
And then tell him what happened the next day, Clint, after you made this program again.
Oh, well, at that meeting, I actually argued and said, you know, because one of the things he wanted the code so that it would flip the vote, but it was undetectable. So even if you saw the source code, you couldn't see where the vote was flipped. And I told him at the meeting, you know, and I don't talk up a lot at these meetings. I just sit there and do my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him at the meeting, you can't do that. Source code is the human-readable language, and any decent programmer can go in, decipher that, and find that there's code that's doing something it shouldn't be doing. Once you compile that code, then it's hidden. So you want to make sure, you know, you don't get blank, blocked source code sitting out there that's already been compiled and put on a machine, because you don't have any idea what it's doing.
And by flip the vote, he meant regardless of who is winning or who is not, it would just switch the numbers?
No, it was actually a little better than that.
Okay.
Come on, I'm better than that. What it did was you pick your candidate on your screen. You wanted, you know, I think I use cat and dog is what I use. So you wanted dog to win. Well, in reality, cat could be winning by any number of votes. Didn't matter. I would take the total number of votes for cat and dog, take 51%, give them to the dog, 49%, give them to the cat.
Hmm.
If there were any third-party candidates, like, you know, mouse, rat, horse, whatever, they would get whatever they had.
Wow. If dog was already winning, what
happened? If dog was already winning, it would do nothing.
Wow.
So, okay, wow. Very...
Oh, it would make sure he had 51% of the vote. If he was winning by 1%, you know, he would get to the 51 mark. It would still up him, but it wouldn't, you know, just ignore it.
That was roughly the outcome of the last election, wasn't it?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
So at what point did you decide that this was something you were kind of morally against, or that you were going to...
Well, I was always morally against it, because I thought they were trying to actually prevent vote fraud. So I not only built the program, I built this big write-up on, you know, what you would need to ensure that you weren't being cheated.
Right.
You know, you need multiple receipts, you need open counts, you need, you know, all sorts of things that you could use to ensure it and make sure it was impossible to cheat it. Well, that seems to be everything that they've decided they don't want, because the laws have been written the other way, which I didn't actually find that out until October of this preceding year.
The laws have been written, how do you mean?
Well, they don't allow you to have a receipt. They don't allow open recounts. You know, they'll select which ones you get to recount.
And these are all the recommendations that you made.
Right. Every recommendation that I made about open source, where you would read the where you'd have every party come in, look at the source code, compile it, hash it in front of them so you know you have the same thing on the machines that everyone expected.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I told them to do is exactly what they're not doing. Now, it's proprietary source code.
When did they do this stuff? Did they do it after you told them not to do it?
Yes, I guess they were... I don't know that much about the development of the actual voting machines that are used by Diebold, ESS, and all this kind of thing. But mine was in 2000.
And let me jump in there for a second, because I think you guys are up in Canada. You use old-fashioned paper and pencil to do your votes up there, don't you?
Most of the time we do. We did just have a referendum here in Nanaimo, in our city, to decide whether or not to go and build a big convention center and hotel, and they actually used the Diebold machine for that referendum.
Oh well, then you didn't decide anything.
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems.
Done for you.
Yeah, I'll mention just for your, you know, for your listeners who may not, you know, understand what's sort of going on down here in the United States, is that these electronic voting machine companies are getting millions of dollars now from the government to essentially privatize public elections. And their hardware and software, it's rather incredible, but their hardware and software, they've declared that it's proprietary, and due to trade secrets, they won't let anyone inspect the actual source code.
So
the votes that we have, the elections that we have, you know, it's essentially the same as if I, you know, said to you guys, hey, tell me who you want to vote for. I will go in secret and record it and count it for you and everybody else in your county, your state, your province, whatever, and you will have to trust me that I've done it accurately. Now, you know, we don't know for sure that there's any hanky-panky going on in this software, but there was enough numbers and enough odd things that happened in November to really make you wonder. I, for one, don't actually think that, you know, it came down to the state of Ohio. I don't think George Bush actually won that state. But because of the way votes are counted in this country now and the way these private companies have said, we don't have to show you our source code, and somehow they got away with this. They don't need to open their source code. So programs like the prototype that Clint Curtis made could well be in the software, and there is no way for election officials, they don't even have permission to find out, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
If the capability is there, I think that's enough to arouse suspicion and to have us, you know, want to do it another way, at least. Especially because we're going all around the world right now fighting for open and free democratic elections. And the process in the States, and I would assume that it will follow suit here. I mean, like I said, we've already seen these Diebold machines in a couple of small referendum elections in Canada, that it's going the same way.
Yeah, don't they say up in Canada that when America sneezes, Canada gets a cold?
Yeah. Exactly.
So, Clint, you're essentially the guy who designed the software that all of these machines, like the Diebold machines and stuff, use now.
Don't know. All I know is that they asked me for it. I delivered it to Mrs. Yang and told her, here's your program, and here's a write-up on how to stop vote fraud. And she jumped in and said, you don't understand. In order to get the contract, we have to hide the manipulation of source code. This is for controlling the vote in South Florida.
What?
That's what she said.
What vote was she talking about? What election are we talking about here?
I'm not sure whether we're talking about an election or all the elections, but...
this is for, so she told you, we need to hide the source code. This is for hiding the vote in South Florida.
Controlling the vote in South Florida.
Yeah.
Apparently South Florida is heavily Democratic.
Right.
And you don't have to win in a Democratic state. You just have to reduce it enough that you can win everything else.
So at what point did you decide that you wanted to go public with this information?
Well, actually, I've been going public with this information. I quit shortly thereafter, obviously.
After after Yang told you that?
Yes, because I figured that didn't even really matter, because you'd have to be a moron to run a program that no one can audit.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't allow it in a bank. Why would you allow it in an election? It didn't make any sense.
It's pretty good that you decided to leave at that point, because a lot of people wouldn't, right? They would just kind of, oh, well, it's my job, you know. So it's interesting.
I think that's right. Most people tell me I was silly. I should have just ignored it and went on. But
what?
You know, that seems to be pretty much the flavor, you know.
Hey, this is America, not Canada, remember?
You know.
So you decided to leave, and then what happened?
Well, I decided to leave. I didn't figure they were doing anything, but there were other meetings afterwards with Feeney to let me know that the guy was a complete crook. I mean, he was talking about repressing the vote with exclusion lists.
Wow.
And all kinds of other things. You know, he was handing out contracts, and basically they were going to dismantle the civil service system so that anyone who had any knowledge would basically be an ought hire, at will employee, so you just fire them if they needed to. And they did that in Florida. This is the odd part. They actually did that. That happened later on. But after I quit, I went and started working for a department in Tallahassee, Department of Transportation, which had the same contract that I'd had under Yang. I wasn't exactly the same job, but same location.
And Yang was the company that you worked for.
Yes. And once they found I was at DOT, they called me up and they were just ballistic. You know, suddenly they were offering me tons of money to come back. Finally, it was, you know, we'll offer all this money. You don't even have to come back. We'll just give you the money. All you have to do is leave Tallahassee. Feeney will find you a job anywhere in the country you want to work.
And so were they essentially asking you to just stay quiet about it?
Right. So I can leave. But, see, I don't even know what they're asking me to stay quiet about. Because I'm assuming the vote fraud is a non-issue, because no one's going to be stupid enough to allow that anyway.
To allow this software.
Right.
Yeah.
Apparently Canadians do too.
Yeah.
Don't you feel honored to, you know, join that club of really stupid people that are just willing to accept things at blind faith?
Exactly. Yeah. It's too true. Why were they alarmed that you were at the Department of Transportation? Why did that?
Well, they've been cooking the books as far as the project that I was working on. Plus, they had an illegal alien, actually a spy, working at the company.
At the Department of Transportation?
And he later got arrested for shipping missile chips to China 20 times.
Oh,
but that took 3 years of contacting the authorities, contacting the Attorney General's office, everything else, even to get that done. So it's a slow go down here.
I'd like to just go back to something just for our listeners who find this, some of them who might find this a bit hard to believe or a bit hard to swallow. You actually went and presented an affidavit and a sworn testimony to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. When
Correct.
Was that?
That was on December 6th.
And were you asked to come in and give this? Like, was there an investigation that was started or...
Well, there was actually some investigating going on about the problems with the elections because, you know, just the fixing is only part of it. There was a lot of problems they were having. The numbers were wrong. You know, they were having a lot of problems. So
we're talking about problems like more votes than voters and all the things that we hear about?
More votes than voters. You know, the exit polls being off much higher than they were in the Ukraine, and we're saying the Ukraine's a fixed election.
And exit polls have been accurate most times since they've been used, I think, right? They're usually a pretty reliable source.
Right. Well, it's the same thing that we said didn't matter here, we complained about in the Ukraine.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, we actually had in the Ukraine, it was actually the same exit polling company, Matovsky Edison, who ran those exit polls in Ukraine. And after those elections where the exit polls showed that the challenger should have won... and in fact, the incumbent ended up winning. After those elections, it almost blows your mind. George W. Bush and Colin Powell came out and said, "Oh, there was fraud in the Ukraine elections." based on the fact that the based solely on the fact that the exit polls in the Ukraine showed the challenger winning, and yet the final results showed the incumbent winning. It was exactly what happened here, and in fact, the spread between the exit polls and the final results here in America was larger than the one in the Ukraine.
And everybody knows this. Everybody knew it at the time that, you know, up here, it's just like it's sort of an accepted thing that, yeah, there was a fraudulent election down in the States last time that got Bush elected. I mean, it seems to be almost common knowledge.
Well, the problem is, as long as they keep these machines, there's going to be that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter who you vote for anymore. It's already been decided.
And so down here, if you bring up the fact that you mentioned that there was a fraudulent election, why you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a liberal who's unhappy with the results of the election,
mm-hmm.
you know, never mind all of the evidence, you know, that shows for the exit polls to have changed from their final results to the actual election results would be, you know, one in it's astronomical odds, you know, something like one in 900 million that this could possibly happen.
Yeah, forget the facts, right?
Right.
Facts are out of fashion.
Right. Who are you going to believe, us? You know, us or your lying eyes?
So let's get back to the timeline. On December the 6th, is this after Feeney offered you the money and the job anywhere? And
Yeah, that was back in, that would have been 2001, right after I left.
Okay.
That's when we got that offer. Then they, you know, I turned them down because obviously the reason I quit was to get away from Feeney.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Taking money and a job from him is not necessarily a good move at that point if you really don't want to be with them. So I went ahead and left, and then they started, you know, well, the vice president of the company used to be a sniper in Vietnam. You know, you won't even see it coming. These kind of comments started coming. So I went and started finding out what in the world was I supposed to know, or did they think that I would know, that I didn't actually know. So I started looking at the books, and they'd been overbilling, and they had the Henry Nee the Spy they'd actually billed for him. And, you know, and I turned it in to a fella at DOT called Ray Lemmy, and he started working on the case.
At the Department of Transportation, Ray
right,
Lemmy.
That would have been May 2001.
So Raymond Lemmy, he was the Inspector General of Florida for the Department of Transportation?
Yes, he was an investigator for the Inspector General's Office.
And why did you turn it in?
The Attorney General's Office.
Why did you turn it into him specifically? Because you were working there? Or?
I was working there.
Okay.
So you take it to whoever, you know. I could take it to the Attorney General's Office, but I'm told it's the same thing. The IG is the, and the information that I found out related directly to DOT, besides the spy and besides, you know,
mm-hmm.
everything else, the overbilling part of it was Department of Transportation.
So he agreed to take it on and to start investigating. And did he start also investigating the whole thing of you being asked to design the software program? And
I don't know what he started investigating. I told him everything. He wrote down the things that applied directly to DOT, signed an affidavit, and acted real excited at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a month or so, he later told me that he'd gotten, you know, political pressure from the top to let it go. They were protected. It didn't matter.
Hmm. And when did he tell you this? Like, did you have meetings with him, or?
Let's continue that part. Talked to him, kept sending him information, kept asking what was going on. Finally, in April 2002, they fired both myself and the manager of the contract that had gone up with me to show her end of it, because she knew about this is a questionable billing and this is a questionable billing, and so she'd gone up there at the same time. So they fired both myself and him on the same day.
From the Department of Transportation?
From the Department of Transportation.
Okay.
So we filed whistleblower suits. She won. My guy filed late, so I didn't. But, so I can't find a job, of course, you know, because I've irritated the political gods. So
right.
I'm unemployed. So eventually I end up with a job stocking shelves at a dollar store.
Wow.
That's kind of like being a NASA programmer, just different.
Right.
And so I'm stocking shelves at a dollar store. In comes Ray Lemmy. And he still wants to work on it because he's intrigued by, you know, the spy, the vote fraud. He had kind of lost his zest a little about defrauding the state. I guess he figured if they didn't care, he didn't care. But he was still asking some questions about that.
And this is after he's been told to cease and desist?
Yes.
Okay.
This is after we've been fired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so he's
yeah.
doing this on his own. He told me, you know, I said, why should I trust you? And he said, officially, there is no investigation at DOT. It's been killed. But there's a lot going on here. I'm going to continue to do it. And he, right after we got fired, I sent it to the press. One person in Daytona Beach picked it up. She'd ran with some stories, and she had a lot of inside information. And Lemmy told me that he was the one who had fed her the inside information, such as the quotes about, you know, the pressure of the politicians from the top to just, you know, let it go away and all this kind of thing.
So maybe, Brad, you want to pick it up here, because you're the investigative reporter who kind of latched onto this story.
Yeah, well, this Ray Lemmy case is really interesting because, you know, as Clint said, he told him in... Where were we, Clint? I think in mid-June of 2003, that this corruption goes all the way to the top. And, yes, 2 weeks later, Ray Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia motel room, which is just pretty much over the border from Tallahassee, Florida. And I asked Clint when he first told me about this, well, what the heck was he doing in Georgia? Clint pointed out that Georgia has no autopsy laws. So had he committed suicide in Florida, there would have been a mandatory autopsy to look into, you know, the suicide and make sure it was what it seemed to be. However, in Georgia, no such thing. And in fact, Ray Lemmy's body was cremated just a few days later and no thorough medical forensic investigation was ever done.
No way.
Now, the odd thing, well, there's a lot of odd things, but... the thing that certainly caught my eye was the police report, which ruled it a suicide, and they said that they took pictures of the scene. However, due to a failure in the camera's flash memory cards, there would be no photograph from the crime scene. Well, I think about a month ago now, posted up on bradblog.com, you can see the photographs of the scene
mm-hmm.
that didn't exist.
That flash was working fine.
What's that?
I've seen the photographs. There's nothing wrong with that flash.
Yeah, they seem to be working fine. And, in fact, now that we see the photographs, we see that there are, in fact, some discrepancies between the photographs and the police report.
Did anybody ask the police, like, how come you didn't know about these photographs, and what was their response?
Well, it was an interesting response, because when I found out about the photographs, I asked them. They said, well, we reopened the case in December of last year due to, quote, interest on the Internet. I have a feeling that would be when I broke the story of Clint Curtis's affidavit, December 6th. So they reopened the case, and they claim that they were somehow able to use new software to get to those photographs. I'm not sure what new software that was, but somehow they were able to use the flashcards and get to the photographs on there. Interestingly enough, they said they reopened the case. Then they spoke with someone at the Florida Department of Transportation and then closed the case shortly thereafter. When I tried to find out from the Valdosta police who they spoke to at the Florida Department of Transportation, they were not very helpful. Well, actually, they were helpful at first. The first call I made, they were very helpful and promised that they would get back to me with some of these questions. Second phone call, when I heard from them the next day, a markedly different tone. They said that we've decided we don't want to talk to the media about this at all. You guys are making something out of this that isn't there, and therefore, you know, we've made our comments. We don't think that this was anything but a suicide, and I'm not trying to stonewall you, but this is what we know. And I said, well, okay, you're not trying to stonewall me. Can you answer me, you know, three questions? And one of them, in fact, was, who did you speak to at the Florida Department of Transportation? He promised I will get, this was on a Friday, he said, I will get back to you on Monday with that and a couple of other pieces of information that I had asked about. For example, there's a great big huge bruise on the side of Raymond Lemmy's neck. Now, he was found in the bathtub, had slit his left arm twice with a double-edged razor blade, and the police report said that there was no other signs of trauma on the body. And yet, if you look at the photographs, you'll see that there is what appears, at least, to be a great big dark patch on the right side of his neck, which would seem to be a bruise.
Yeah, it looks pretty much like a bruise, especially in the darkened photograph that you did. Let's give that website again so people can check
that's
it out.
That's bradblog.com. If you want to get all the skinny on the Clint Curtis story, and it has been, you know, there's quite a bit of information on it. I've been reporting on it since early December, and there have been more twists and turns to this thing and interesting reactions from Feeney and from Yang and their attorneys. You can go to bradblog.com/clintcurtis.htm and sort of get all of the key articles in this story, along with a lot of the hard evidence that I've been putting up there, public records, court documents, things like the farewell card that they gave Clint Curtis when Yang threw him a going-away party. The reaction from everyone, Yang, Feeney, their attorneys, was, oh, Clint Curtis is a disgruntled employee. Well, you know, disgruntled employees aren't usually thrown, you know, farewell parties and told by the CEO that they can come back anytime they want. So it's a lot of hard evidence that we try to put up there. We try to stay away from stuff that is not, you know, confirmable. And the problem is, you know, I've been looking into the story since December. I have yet to be able to find a hole in Clint's story, yet I find hole after hole after hole in everything that Yang says, everything that Feeney says, every time they open their mouths. So far, at least, I got to go with Clint Curtis on this one. And just last week, the news was broken that Clint Curtis took a polygraph test, and he passed.
Hmm. Well done, Clint.
Better than that, it was like the head guy, the retired chief polygraph guy for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Like 20 years of experience, everybody says you can't beat this guy. So, God, he's not like some flunky we got off the road. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, he's passed polygraph test. I wonder if Mr. Feeney would like to take a polygraph test since he keeps calling Clint Curtis a liar. You know, I don't know if Clint's a liar or not, but I certainly can't find anything to suggest he's lying. And as I said, he passed the polygraph. Oddly enough, though, Tom Feeney has done, as have Yang, have done interesting things like threatening a Florida newspaper, the Seminole Chronicle, who reported on Clint's affidavit and on his testimony before members of the House Judiciary Committee. They reported on that fact in a story. That's all they did, was report on what the affidavit said and what he said in his testimony. And for thanks, they received a chilling letter from both Feeney's attorney and Yang's attorney, almost identical letters. And mind you, as Clint mentioned, Feeney was once the attorney for Yang, and Yang's attorneys are still, Yang's attorneys is a group called Fowler and O'Quinn. They used to be called Fowler, Barris, Feeney and O'Quinn. So they're very tight there. They've threatened this newspaper, saying that they've defamed Tom Feeney. Oddly enough, Clint, have you ever gotten a threat from Tom Feeney, to a lawsuit from Tom Feeney?
No, but I'd invite one anytime.
So oddly enough, the guy who actually is making the claim, suggesting that Feeney is crooked, he hasn't been threatened by Tom Feeney.
The newspaper
I wonder
has.
Why.
So I'm wondering about Raymond Lemmy. How likely is it that he was suicidal? Or like, has his family come out and said anything? Or and like, why he was in Georgia? Or
so far, there's no explanation of why he was in Georgia, at least no explanation that I've been able to receive. And mind you, what I pointed out concerning the photographs, that was only one of many discrepancies in this police report. You know, for example, they show a check-in receipt at the motel on June 29th, and in fact, Ray Lemmy was in Tallahassee on June 29th. He didn't leave Tallahassee to go to Valdosta until the morning of June 30th. So there's a lot of discrepancies there. Now, as far as the family goes, only some of them have been willing to talk, and even those were not willing to talk on the record. So there seems to be a difference of feeling within the family as far as, you know, was it murder, was it suicide? I think that everybody agrees, however, that they were absolutely stunned that Lemmy would commit suicide, if in fact it was, that they had no sign of it. He was not, as far as they know, on any kind of antidepressants or anything like that. However, because there was no autopsy, we don't know if he was on any antidepressants for sure. But, you know, they were all absolutely stunned that this would happen. His co-workers seemed to a T agree that this was very much out of character for him. And by the way, to just sort of corroborate what Clint has said, that Lemmy told him that he was, you know, the corruption goes all the way to the top. His wife, Lemmy's wife, Marianne, in the police report also says that Lemmy had been under a lot of stress lately because he had been working on a quote, big case And in fact, I heard from someone right now. I'll sort of break this off the record. A friend of Lemmy's who also spoke with him not long before he died, and corroborates in fact that Lemmy also told this person that he had been working on a big case. So we'll make of that what you will.
Thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with us today, guys.
My pleasure.
And yeah, thanks for doing this. Perhaps dangerous work.
You know what? Thank Clint. I mean, he's been, frankly, risking his life and reputation and everything else on this story for, boy, about 4 years now. So I have to give big props to Clint for staying on this thing and not becoming intimidated, because I know he's had a lot of threats, a lot of strange things have happened, and hell, if it was me, I would have gotten off this story long ago, but if he can keep going, then I guess I can keep going.
Right on.